Yes, so the title of my talk, as you know, is The Post-American World. I could also have called it American Decline and the Future of the Liberal International Order, but I thought that might get fewer of you to turn out. So here we go, short and snappy. I'm told that the point of the Sydney Greats is to introduce big, basic, foundational ideas. So that's what I've tried to do. I've tried to take a foundational question and boil it down to a level where hopefully it's something that is easily understandable to a non-international relations audience, although I see a few people in the audience who do know a thing or two about international relations theory. So one of the most foundational questions in international relations, one of the things that we IR theorists, as we call ourselves, like to think about, is or centers on the causes and consequences of the rise and decline of nations. What happens when some states grow in power and others wane? What are the consequences for international order and stability when one dominant state rises and replaces another? Now, when studying power shifts, most scholars focus on the probability of systemic instability and large-scale war. Thucydides, to take the earliest example, was arguing that the rise of Athens within the Greek city's state system was what made war with Sparta not just probable, but inevitable. Now, these days, a central preoccupation of a large swath of international relations scholarship is how to evaluate the extent, the speed, and the likely geopolitical consequences of an ongoing decline in American power. Debates about the deterioration of American hegemony are not new at all. They began in earnest in the 1980s when lots of academics and policymakers began to worry that American power was declining in relative terms. And indeed, it was. In fact, relative to other major states in the international system, the US has been constantly declining since 1945. That's a point I'll come back to in a bit. But still, to many observers, American dominance appeared to get a generous new lease of life with the end of the Cold War, ushering in a period of unrivaled American power, a unipolar moment, as many called it. The fall of the Soviet bloc made it seem as if America was now unconstrained, whether militarily, economically, or ideologically. This was America's Roman moment, many observers felt. That certainly seemed to be the idea at Washington at the dawn of the 21st century, when the very strongly unilateral policies of the second Bush administration appeared to recognize few limitations on American power. Yet today, just a decade on, most scholars would argue that if there ever was a unipolar moment, it was very brief, and that now we're in the throes of a large-scale historical power transition that is going to see American power, if not eclipsed by one or more rising challenges, then at least significantly counterbalanced and constrained. Okay? So this raises one of those big, important questions, namely, what is the global order going to look like after American dominance ends? Will the international liberal order that America is widely credited with having built after its rise to dominance persist after America's material decline? And if so, will it continue to be based upon the same liberal values, principles, and rules that have characterized it so far? Or will the international order as we know it disintegrate as rising new powers seek to replace it with an alternative order that more closely tracks their own interests? Well, my aim in this seminar is to try to examine some of the implications of America's decline for the global institutional infrastructure, by which I mean simply the prevailing system of rules, norms, and legal institutional practices that govern multilateral cooperation in the world today. Now, it's widely accepted that the bedrock of this institutional order, I've forgotten to point to my handsome assistants, that's American unipolarity. Thank you, Mika. And this is the definition of a global institutional order. It's widely accepted that the bedrock of this global institutional order has been a willingness by the United States to use its dominant power in order to supply a variety of so-called public goods, from which all states in the system have benefited. These goods have included the provision of regional and international stability. It has included maintaining an open world economy and stabilizing economic and financial systems. It's also included founding and bankrolling major institutions for multilateral cooperation, such as the UN system, NATO, the International Monetary Fund, and the World Bank. Now, if we accept that view, then we're bound to worry that a weakening of America's power is going to trigger fundamental changes to the global order, to international cooperation. But in what direction are those changes likely to run? That's what I want to discuss. But before we do so, we need to consider whether America is actually declining. Most of the arguments I'm going to present presuppose that it is. And in the long run, undoubtedly, that is the case. Whether we call them great powers, superpowers, empires, hegemons, the field of international relations has one clear prediction with respect to dominant states. They rise and they fall. Now, there's several reasons for this. Some scholars point to dynamics of imperial overstretch. Paul Kennedy, a British historian at Yale, who you may have heard about, introduced this idea in a famous book called The Rise and Decline of the Great Powers, in which he argued that dominant powers tend to get embroiled in military conflicts far afield, and that leads them to spend more and more on military power to the detriment of their economies, and as a result, they decline. This fate befell Britain in the late 19th century, and the same fate, many worry, may be befalling America today as it launches liberal interventions in far corners of the world without gaining much advantage from doing so. Other explanations for decline point to a steady diffusion of technological knowledge and innovation away from dominant states towards other states in the system, which means that the latter eventually catch up. This fate also seems to have befallen 19th century Britain as other European states caught up with industrialization. Either way, the central prediction is the same in terms of power: what goes up must come down. Historically, the fall of dominant power seems close to an iron law. The Roman, Ottoman, Austrian, Russian, Soviet empires, despite their temporary greatness, all fell by the wayside. I think we have a nice slide of Britain's deroute. Now, eventually all dominant states decline, but is decline happening to America now, and if so, how fast? Well, as I said, in relative terms, US power has been declining since the end of the Second World War. In 1945, the US alone accounted for more than 50% of global production. Americans were behind 82% of all major inventions and innovations. With only 6% of the world's population, the US held on to more than half of the world's monetary gold and financial reserves. And of course, America had a monopoly on nuclear weapons, so it was a pretty cushiony position. Now, that didn't last very long. In 49, as you know, the Russians went nuclear, other states soon followed. And by 75, America's share of global production had slipped from more than half to less than a quarter. Other states were also beginning to catch up with American productivity and innovation. But still, America appeared uniquely powerful. Now, power, of course, is a relative term, and as such, you cannot gauge the power of one state in isolation from that of others. But power is also a concept that it's difficult to measure in material terms only, without also paying attention to wider geopolitical structures and dynamics. Now, apart from the Soviet Union, whose growth rates we now know to have been vastly exaggerated for much of the Cold War, the economies that were catching up fastest during the post-war period, France, Germany, Italy, Japan, were all close American allies. Their resources, in some sense, were merely added to the enormous wealth and power of the US. But during the 80s, that began to change as American growth slowed down, and as other developing states began to grow fast. China's economy grew by an average of 10% annually during the 80s and 90s. India charged ahead. And this trend has continued and been reinforced in the 21st century due in part to the global financial crisis. So where are we today? Well, in a recent book on the topic, Fareed Zakaria, whom some of you may be reading, it's a sort of popular take on the fall of American hegemony, notes that many of the traditional symbols of global power are no longer to be found in the United States. The tallest building in the world is in Dubai, the richest man is Mexican, the largest publicly traded company is Chinese, and the biggest movie budgets, I believe, are to be found in India. What does that matter, you may say? Well, not much, I think. But there are other trends that do matter. In 2010, China replaced the US as the world's leading manufacturing nation. And the IMF today forecasts that China's world share of world GDP is going to surpass America's already in 2022. It keeps coming closer. Next slide, this takeover. That's a mere 8 years from now. China's education budget now accounts for more than 4% of its GDP. To give you a basis for comparison, OECD countries spend on average 6%. So this suggests that China's knowledge and skills base is rapidly strengthening. And of course, China is the world's second largest military spender. There are other indicators as well of America's dwindling power. It's growing, it's declining oil production, and it's declining cultural appeal, and the strange correlation between the two that this slide suggests. Never mind, say the crime deniers, who are mainly to be found on the American right. Other states may be growing fast economically, but no other state comes even close to matching American military power. In terms of military force, the US outspends the next 20 countries in the world combined. And moreover, it has bases and troops stationed all over the world, as we will see on the next slide. This is an amazing picture. The white spots are countries in which the US doesn't have a significant military presence. And the stripy ones are ones where they have opened more than 10 new military bases since 9/11. And everywhere else is just littered with American troops and bases, to give you some idea of the reach of American military dominance. Of course, if we buy Kennedy's thesis, then this will only hasten American decline. But more importantly, I think, comparisons of military spending tell us very little about what influence a country can gain through the application of military force. As I said, a country's military strength must be assessed not only through comparison with other states, but also in relation to its fundamental geostrategic interests and commitments. Now here, many would argue, of course, that the sudden disappearance of Soviet threat was a major boon to American military power. But while America emerged from the Cold War without a single challenger in military terms, it also emerged to a world in which its geostrategic interests grew a lot more complex. Right? So the end of bipolarity brought a lot of new threats from failing states, from nationalist movements, from international terrorism. The disintegration of the Soviet Union led to a rapid diffusion of weapons of mass destruction throughout the world, which is something I work on quite a lot, either through smuggling or theft or sale. And as a result, America now faces several new states armed with nuclear weapons. To make matters worse, the end of the Cold War also revealed serious limitations on the utility of America's conventional power, as its liberal interventions in countries like Afghanistan and Iraq proved largely ineffective. And none of it was made easier by the fact that there was no longer a militant global ideological alternative to the US that it could use as reason to its allies for lending support to American foreign policy goals. So in short, being an unrivaled military power may not be all that it's cracked up to be. So what are the implications of this malaise? Well, are we to conclude that we will soon see American dominance replaced by one or a handful of major rivals? Many scholars think so, and international relations scholars today are busy writing sort of semi-popular books about the next hegemon, the Chinese century, what will it look like? Chinese interests and values differ fundamentally from Americans in respect to issues such as sovereignty, human rights, self-determination, they point out. So we're in for big changes. Now, I think such speculation, even though it probably sells a lot of books, is a bit premature. While America faces numerous constraints on its power, so too do all its major rivals. Rising great powers such as China, Brazil, and India are all plagued by endogenous weaknesses that make it difficult for them to project power globally. They have poor industrial infrastructures, they have mounting demographic pressures, they have domestic political instability and weak alliance relations. So the upshot is that whereas American dominance is declining, no single challenger is likely to be able to take the place at the helm for now to replace American dominance. As the historian Charles Kupchan has recently argued, American hegemony is giving way not to another form of hegemony, but to a no one's world. Okay? So what does no one's world look like? Well, to answer that question, we must first look back at what American dominance has actually meant for the international system. And an important concept in that respect is that of hegemonic stability. Now, the theory, perhaps the biggest theory in international relations when it comes to sort of grand strategy and theory, is that of hegemonic stability, which was introduced by the economist Charles Kindleberger in 1973. In a nutshell, it holds that an open and stable international economic system requires a dominant state to perform basic military and economic tasks. Militarily, the hegemon stabilizes key regions in the world through the threat or promise, depending on how you look at it, of military intervention. It also guards the global commons, for instance, by securing free navigation on the seas and in international airspace, as well as, in the case of this hegemon, space and cyberspace. The hegemon also stabilizes the system economically by opening its large domestic market to distressed goods from other states, and by acting as a lender of last resort, supplying liquidity to international markets. In doing so, the theory goes, the hegemon is essentially supplying public goods on which other states can free ride because they cannot feasibly be excluded from the benefits of a stable international system. So the hegemon, as the only state strong enough to supply effective leadership, pays the full price of stabilizing the system of being international policemen, while other states share in the benefits without contributing much. And as a result, they grow relatively. Now, you'll be well aware that Britain played the role of hegemon until the 19th century. And when British hegemony declined, the theory goes there followed a period of instability, rather two world wars to be precise, until America stepped in the 20th century and used its preponderant power to construct a new liberal order referred to as Pax Americana. Now, what's important to note about Pax Americana is that it is both more comprehensive and much more institutionalized than British hegemony ever was. In the security realm, it consisted of a global web of bilateral and multilateral alliances, as well as, we saw, the stationing of American troops and military bases all over the world in order to guarantee the security of client states. In the economic realm, the US bore the bulk of the cost of reconstructing defeated states after the Second World War. It maintained stable frameworks for economic exchange through major international institutions such as the GATT, the IMF, and the World Bank. And America played a key financial role by supplying the world's principal currency for international transactions, namely the dollar, and by acting as a lender of last resort. So pretty important elements of international order. Now you may ask, why does the hegemon supply all these generous public goods upon which other states free ride? Well, collective action theory tells us that the main reason a dominant state will supply goods for the international system and let other states free ride is that it receives the largest share of benefits arising from those goods, right? So because the hegemon has the largest population, the largest territory, the largest markets, it stands to gain the most in absolute terms from a world that is characterized by stability, peace, and free trade. So on this account, the US has created and bankrolled the post-war liberal order not because it was benevolent, but essentially because it gained from doing so. The next slide captures that idea. So what happens next? If American hegemony is fast fading, what's going to happen to this system of rules and institutions and multilateral frameworks for cooperation that America built and which continues to provide a basis for cooperation in much of the world today? Well, there's two broad views in current international relations scholarship on that. One pessimistic, let's call it the realist view, and one much more optimistic, let's call it the liberal view. I'll start with the pessimistic view. Realists are pretty unambiguous in their predictions of doom. International orders and the institutions on which they rest are maintained by dominant states through the constant use of threatened rewards, they argue. And so when a dominant state loses power, when it loses ability to manage the system through threats and rewards, international order rapidly disintegrates, possibly to be replaced by new cooperative structures that better reflect the interests of newly powerful states, possibly to be replaced by chaos. As historian Robert Kagan reminds us, every international order in history has reflected the beliefs and the interests of the strongest powers, and every international order has changed when power shifted to others with different beliefs and interests. I think Charles Kupchan puts it more credibly when he says, the Chinese ship will not dock obediently in the American harbor. The world should brace itself for instability. Now, liberals, as I said, are much more optimistic. They recognize that as the power of the hegemon declines, so too does its ability to grease the wheels and manage international cooperation. Yet, they argue, the result is not necessarily a collapse of international cooperation. In a book titled After Hegemony, Bob Cohen, a famous political scientist, he wrote this book in 84, speculated that cooperation might survive after a hegemon's decline if other smaller states would join forces in order to maintain the existing structure of institutions. Given that all states benefit from stability, he argued, there would be a continued demand for international institutions, and since rules and institutions are much cheaper to maintain than to create, there would be an incentive for other states to maintain the system when the hegemon bows out. Now that analysis, I think, warrants at best cautious optimism because it rather assumes that the collective action problem inherent in the supply of public goods can somehow magically be solved in the absence of a dominant state that can use its power to arbitrate between conflicting interests and enforce agreements. And Cohen himself recognized that that is difficult. He was only cautiously optimistic, therefore, thinking that cooperation might continue for a while, sort of out of habit, before it then started to decline. So while some elements of liberal institutional infrastructure might survive the decline of American hegemony, the institutions would be weaker, they would be less comprehensive than under hegemonic rule. But there's a second strand of liberalism which is much more strongly optimistic. This view contends that the American world order is going to persist, more or less indefinitely, even if American primacy does not. And the reason is that unlike previous international orders, Pax Americana creates generous material benefits, not just for the United States, but for the entire world. Indeed, other states often gain more from cooperation within the liberal system from free trade than America itself does. And this provides an incentive for them to continue to play by existing rules. Now, one of the strongest proponents of this argument is a political scientist at Princeton called John Eikenberry. He has argued forcefully in a number of books that because it builds on consent and on joint decision-making, the American-sponsored liberal world order is, as he says, easy to join, very difficult to overthrow. So long as the US is willing to accommodate emerging powers' interests, expand their role in decision-making a little bit here and there, the liberal order, he thinks, is likely to remain the preferred means by which states address common international problems. Now, that sounds really good, but let's examine the argument in a bit more detail. Liberals of the John Aikenberry brand offer two main reasons why Pax Americana is likely to endure. The first is that, unlike previous international orders, Pax Americana is based not on a unilateral imposition of power, but rather on power sharing through international institutions. So Aikenberry would argue that a core feature of the liberal order is that it institutionalizes opportunities for all states to project some element of power and influence. It does so, for instance, through principles of majoritarian voting in most multilateral decision fora. And in doing so, it creates incentives for everyone to participate within the system. To liberals, the fact that America has agreed to share power with other states through international institutions is precisely what makes its rule so durable. Okay? A hegemon, they argue, can expect fewer challenges to a system in which other states have a formal voice, because America is not overtly privileged within existing multilateral institutions. A diffusion of power to other states is not necessarily going to prompt them to challenge the system. And so by acting in a benign way, the US has been extremely farsighted. It has succeeded in locking in an institutional liberal order that's going to continue to benefit American interests even as its power declines. Now, the second reason why liberals are optimistic, and that is that they believe that Pax Americana, again, unlike previous international orders, rests not just on military and economic might, in this case exercised through international institutions, but also on widely accepted cultural norms and values. Many of you will have heard of an argument by Joseph Nye that the attractiveness of American ideology and culture, America's so-called soft power, draws others into its orbit. This argument is echoed by a bunch of scholars, one of them being Fareed Zakaria, who argues that despite its material decline, America will remain the pivotal power in international politics simply because there remains a strong ideological demand for American leadership. Okay, so in these conditions, liberals believe America can essentially do more with less. Okay, so which view is right? Well, when looking at China, India's, Brazil's foreign policy in the last decade, it's tempting to conclude that liberals probably are onto something, right? Overall, these states that are currently rising seem fairly content to rise within the existing system. China joined the WTO, the World Trade Organization, in 2001, and China and other emerging powers have been eager to assume more responsibility in institutions such as the IMF and the World Bank, where they now provide a lot of the financial resources that go towards lending and stabilizing the international economy, as the US provides less. These countries are also becoming important bilateral donors of development aid. Now, of course, we can easily find examples pointing in the opposite direction. An increasingly defiant Russia that refuses to respect the sovereignty of neighboring countries like Georgia or these days Ukraine. Chinese buildup of military power in the South China Sea, or efforts by China, as many see it, to push out former colonial powers like Britain and France from Africa by giving generous, no strings attached aid to African countries. I would suggest that such snapshots of current events are very unlikely to tell us much about long-term trends. If we want to gaze into the crystal ball and try to get a better idea of what's in store, and this, by the way, is not an exercise that should be generally encouraged, but it makes for a better talk. If we want to try to project long-term trends, we need to consider each argument, the realist and the liberal, under theoretical merits. And on these grounds, I would argue that both views are probably getting it wrong. Here's why. Both realists and liberals are worried primarily about challenges to the American world order from outside the system, from rising states such as China, Brazil, and India, that want to replace the liberal order with another order more to their own liking. But I'd suggest that the system is more likely to be challenged and undone from within. How does that work? Well, after all, what matters for the durability of American for Pax Americana is not only whether other states are willing to accept an element of continued American leadership and dominance, but also whether America is willing and able to continue to supply a significant element of leadership for this order. And here I think the liberals are much too optimistic. I'll offer you three reasons why. That's going to be the next slide again. Go on. And one more push. The first reason is simple, based on collective action theory. It suggests that a reduction in America's material power is, per necessity, going to limit the resources that it has available to it to engage in institution building and to punish or reward other states for cooperation. Liberals hope that other states will step in to help, but in no one's world, there are no obvious contenders who could step up to the plate to provide a serious element, certainly of military, but also not of economic leadership to support an extension of Pax Americana. Even the US's closest allies in Europe and Asia are dramatically reducing their defense budgets. They have not contributed anything of substance to recent American interventions in Afghanistan, and in Libya they have been reluctant to act without American support. Financially, the euro, once a viable, seemingly viable, alternative to the dollar, is in tatters. So there are no other takers for the leadership position right now. So, and declining America is finding it harder to supply effective leadership, either alone or in cooperation with its allies. But there's a second problem. As we have also seen from collective action theory, a main reason why a dominant state would choose to supply public goods such as open markets and financial stability is that due to its preponderant size, it gains the most from doing so. It benefits the most from those goods. As the US loses power, as its economy shrinks relative to others, its share of global benefits are also invariably going to shrink, and it will have fewer incentives, therefore, to pick up the cost of providing public goods for the international system as a whole. So not only is the US less able, it is probably also less willing to supply leadership. The third reason why liberal optimism is misplaced is that institutional lock-in doesn't actually work. The idea that the power-neutral institutions of Pax Americana will continue to serve American interests long beyond the decline of its material power, I think, rests on somewhat shaky grounds. International institutions essentially benefit you most when you can control what goes on within them. The institutions that America created and gave to the world in the post-war period were not exactly power-neutral. Voting in most international institutions was and remains weighted, giving more power to powerful states. And America always called the shots within the multilateral and bilateral alliances that it formed, as you will know, certainly it did within NATO. Today, however, the balance of power within many global institutions is beginning to shift. Through several rounds of reform, voting power within the World Bank, within the IMF, has been redistributed towards newly developing states. Institutions that have not been reformed to reflect a different power reality, such as, say, the UN Security Council or the WTO, are increasingly finding themselves deadlocked as a result. But it's not just the BRICS being short for Brazil, Russia, India, and China, the countries that are seen to be most rapidly rising. It's not just these countries that are growing more assertive and more demanding of voice within major multilateral institutions. Since they now depend less urgently on American military protection than they once used to, America's key allies in Europe and Asia have also proved less willing to support American policy or to have their own foreign policies dictated from Washington. Their support for the US is increasingly growing conditional. We saw this, of course, in Iraq, where Washington had to use a lot of political and indeed financial capital in order to assemble a viable fighting coalition. So in short, as American power shrinks, it's increasingly difficult for Washington to dictate policy through multilateral institutions. What this means essentially is that multilateralism is starting to not pay off, not yield the same benefits as it once did. Now, there are other challenges as well, I think, that liberals tend to overlook. American liberals insist that Pax Americana has been the most successful international order in history because it has led to unprecedented economic growth and prosperity for all nations. Now, we may wonder, would it have been so successful in the presence of constraints on economic growth? Going forward from where we are today, environmental scarcity brought on by climate change, by overpopulation, may mean that even if we do maintain an open liberal world economy, there will be severe reductions in overall economic growth rates. Now, if America continues to play the role of hegemon and guardian of the global commons, it's going to find itself in a position where it's no longer presiding over a growing pie, but rather where it's trying to manage the collective consumption of a rapidly shrinking pie. That's a very different prospect. It's difficult to do, especially on a shoestring budget. Finally, I think liberals tend to overlook a strong strand of isolationism within America itself. In the long run, the provision of global leadership requires firm support from domestic populations. Yet, Americans may be tiring of playing the role of global policeman. Americans' own view of the United States as a global power seem to have reached a historic low. In a recent Pew poll, for the first time in almost 40 years, a majority of Americans said that they believe the US plays a less important role as a global power than it did just a decade ago. And for the first time, more than half of all Americans asked agreed with the statement that the US should mind its own business internationally and let other countries get along the best they can on their own. Now, that doesn't bode very well for the longevity of the American-run liberal order either. So in closing, and in order to leave you with something for discussion, how should we expect America to react to these changes and challenges? Well, as I already hinted, I think one likely implication of America's declining power is that it will be much less inclined than it has been to bear the cost of creating new international institutional structures. Liberal scholars are virtually unanimous in arguing that the reason hegemonic states build strong international institutions is that they wish to legitimize their power, make it more acceptable to other states, which in turn reduces their cost of supplying leadership and forestalls challenges to their rule. Yet, as America declines, it is going to grow less concerned with showing constraint or making its growing power acceptable to others, and more concerned with capitalizing on the resources it still has in order to project its foreign policy goals and interests. It seems, therefore, that the US should be less inclined to make long-term investments into institution building. America will also be less likely, I think, to challenge its foreign policy through major multilateral institutions, as I have argued these are increasingly deadlocked and increasingly unlikely to yield results that match American priorities. Rather, in the areas where the US still has sufficient power to go it alone, we should expect it to bypass major multilateral decision fora and simply go it alone, act unilaterally, or assemble smaller coalitions of the willing. Now, how do we know if any of this is remotely plausible? Well, I think we see both trends in the international system already. During the 90s already, the far-sighted strategy of formal institution building that characterized American hegemony in the post-war years began slowly but securely to give way to a more reluctant multilateralism. Washington remained aloof from the global efforts to ban landmines, declined to implement the Kyoto Protocol. The US has been reluctant to join international treaty agreements on biological warfare, on criminal justice, on women's rights. And it has also opposed the Comprehensive Test Ban Treaty. And of course, America is one of only two states to have refused to ratify the Convention on Children's Rights, the other country being Somalia. So increasingly, whatever it is, if it's legalized in an international treaty agreement, the US is unhappy to sign it. The Bush administration in many ways went further than refusing to sign on to new international treaty regimes. It also unsigned the Rome Treaty, which established an international criminal court, and it has declared itself no longer bound by the Vienna Convention on the Law of Treaties, which dictates the obligation of all states to abide by treaties they have signed but not yet ratified. And that decision has not yet been overturned. So in short, I would suggest to you that whereas China and other rising powers have spent the last two decades seeking to join major international organizations, the US has been busy trying to exit them or ignoring them when they generated results that Washington was unhappy with, such as when the UN Security Council failed to say yes to the US intervention in Iraq. Now, the reason that I've given you in very broad strokes is that in a world where power is increasingly evenly distributed, the international multilateral system that the US built in the post-war periods is no longer delivering benefits that are proportionate to the costs of maintaining it. Now, where that leads us 10, 20, 50 years down the line, I'm not quite sure. For the foreseeable future, most international scholars, specialists would argue we are likely to be in a sort of limbo, and I've given you some very rudimentary ideas on what that's going to look like, and I'll be happy to entertain your questions.
Thank you.